one of the commonest metaphors that people have used to talk about what happens in practice is the metaphor of seeing things clearly, or seeing things the way they really are, as opposed to seeing them through a set of filters, or the way we think of our preoccupations or delusions as distorting lenses or rose-colored glasses, something that's going to, one way or another, distort our vision. And a very common metaphor for what happens with enlightenment is that we take off these glasses, we remove these lenses of delusion, and for the first time see things as they really are, see reality as it is. This metaphor depends on a kind of very basic distinction that we take for granted between appearances and reality, between how things look to us versus how they really are. And again, it's sort of we take for granted that, of course, that distinction exists in the world. Now, while these metaphors are useful under certain circumstances to describe how we can be deceived by our senses, or deceived by what we think is going on, they conceal some fundamental confusions that actually perpetuate some of the very problems that they claim to clarify. See, one of the core ideas in Buddhism is non-separation or non-dualism. That, and this means, in a certain sense, not seeing the world always divided into subjects and objects. A subject that stands back here and looks out at a world which it never knows directly, but only knows through taking in data from the senses, sight or sound or touch, and then forming some picture or representation in the mind or in the brain of what's out there based on this data. And that picture can be relatively true or relatively false, depending on how good the data is and how good we are at processing it. What we don't usually appreciate in practice is that if we talk about non-separation, it really means, in some sense, giving up that whole representation slash picture view of our relationship to the world. That we're not apart from the world, gaining more or less perfect information about something outside or apart from ourselves, but we in the world are constantly mutually defining, interacting, and co-creating whole. We're so used to the other way of thinking that it's very hard to even frame what the alternative might be like. But one of the places we can start is to try to get away from the primacy of seeing, the primacy of the visual as the paradigm for knowing. See, the visual sort of automatically sort of presumes this kind of gap between me and the world that we have to then try to bridge. But if we start with knowledge, not being knowledge of what we see, but knowledge of what we do, we start to put together a different kind of picture. Then we're talking about embodied language or embodied knowledge, or knowledge that comes through an awareness of the movement and action of our body in space. It's been suggested that the earliest forms of consciousness that go all the way down the evolutionary spectrum is a kind of is proprioception or awareness of how your body is positioned in space. The first sense of who I am is this bodily sense of where I am and what I can do and what I can pick up or push on or stand on without falling over. My knowledge of the world is this kind of preconceptual experience of what I can do. See, when we learn what we can do, we're not necessarily creating a picture or representation that's right or wrong. You could sort of say the paradigm of that is the kind of way in which we learn to ride a bicycle or play catch. You can't do either of those things from an instruction manual. If you try to break down what's involved into a series of rules, you get completely flummoxed. But you can gradually develop a kind of bodily know-how that you do automatically. One of the ways people try to develop an alternative to this Cartesian dualistic visual model of how we are in the world came from the Gestalt psychologists at the turn of the 20th century. And their basic insight was that when we experience the world or see something, we're not taking in lots of little bits of data and then assembling them into a picture inside our head. What they discovered when they really examined perception in a very detailed kind of way was that patterns precede particulars, that we take in the world whole rather than build it up piecemeal inside. This is sort of like the bicycle issue. You don't learn to ride the bicycle step by step. You sort of clumsily try out the whole thing and try it over and over again until the whole gets smoother. You don't assemble it from a set of discrete movements. One of the most basic ways in which the world comes at us is in terms of figure and ground. What do we notice and why? See, what counts as an object against the background? What do we notice? So early research about the visual system in a frog, tried to figure out how does a frog, sit there and when a fly goes by, tongue goes out and gets the fly, zaps the fly. You see, in a certain sense, if you were imagining trying to make a robot to do that, you would have this, supercomputer inside the frog's brain that would, try to estimate the velocity of the fly and map its trajectory on a kind of mental graph, calculate its motion, and then predict where your tongue needs to be at a certain amount of time in order to intersect with the fly's trajectory. Well, frogs don't do anything like that. They really don't know much algebra or calculus. And what they found was that the frog's eye, basically conveyed only the information of movement against the background. And it said when there was movement against the background, it triggered a certain kind of reflex in the frog. There was no calculation involved. Now you see, when the eye was basically just a movement detector, but also a definer of foreground and background. You see, if you come into a room and you see a table and chairs up against the wall on which there's a painting, and then the wall is covered with wallpaper. When we look at that, we tend to pick out the chair and the table and the picture and the wallpaper. Basically, the frog would just look at that and see all wallpaper. Right? It's all background. There's no reason the chair or the table or the picture would stand out or have any relevance to the frog because they're all stationary objects, and all stationary objects are equal. Right. But when we go into that room, we might have various reasons to be able to pick out a difference between stationary objects. And that picture of things comes at us whole. Our distinguishing foreground and background, though, is very situation dependent. What we pick out depends on what matters to us. If you're walking along the sidewalk and there's a big flock of pigeons that flies up into your face, basically your experience is of a flock of pigeons. You don't have any need or really couldn't pick out one pigeon among the others unless it actually hits you in the face, right? You don't distinguish. That all blurs together. Basically, what the Gestalt psychologists were saying, and this gets amplified by Merleau-Ponty and Heidegger and Wittgenstein in all sorts of interesting ways we can discuss in the discussion group if you don't stop me. is that we organize our experience. Our experience, in a sense, comes pre-organized to us in stories of relevance, in stories of a complex situational background that we take in and call it perception. There is no raw data onto which we add our story, right? That's the crux of this appearance versus reality distinction, that there is a raw data reality out there, and we construe it in some idiosyncratic way, or tell some personal story about it, what matters to us. But that is a layer that can be peeled off, right? That in some sense that there is a natural dividing line between story and data underneath, right? And what the Gestalt psychologists and the all these various philosophers trying to come up with an alternative to Cartesian dualism tell us is that if we're going to give up this dualistic picture, one of the prices we're going to pay is we're also going to give up this appearance versus reality distinction, that reality is always going to be in some sense reality for us. Now, we could say that means that in some sense, it's stories all the way down. And we will inevitably organize our experience in lots of complex background ways that we're unaware of, even as we think we're seeing things directly. Right? When we sit in Zazen, we may have this very wonderful experience of feeling like there's not a thought in our head and we're just sitting and we're just feeling ourselves breathe, and we might just look out at the room and we see things just as they are without any kind of interference by thinking, right? Because we imagine thinking is this verbal, conceptual, inner dialogue that's going through our head and which can stop. But the lesson of this non-dualistic approach is that the thinking is actually going on at a far more subtle level that organizes all our experience in ways that we're not aware of. A kind of obvious way in which this is played out is that seemingly enlightened masters who are adept at seeing things the way they are, nonetheless, to anybody from the outside, clearly have all sorts of cultural and gender and power-oriented preconceptions about their role in authority and men and women and all sorts of things, what it's like to be Japanese versus Western, all these things that are so deeply ingrained that they're part of the taken-for-granted background. Yeah? And that there's no kind of Kensho experience that wipes away that deep background, revealing things as they really are. Right? Even in these very dramatic koans where the monk tries to ask some fancy question about what is Buddha nature, and the master just hauls off and smacks him upside the head. Where that blow to the head is supposed to represent a kind of immediate, non-verbal, non-conceptual experience. Just this, right? But it's all taking place in a context that's both of them recognize as teaching, right? None of these stories involve the monk saying, what the devil did you do that for, and slugging him back, right? There's no the whole idea of the blow is in the context of what's a teacher, what's a student, how do you respond to an action by a teacher. So you see, so even though the smack upside the head is supposed to be, you know, non-conceptual immediacy, that is only happening in a unquestioned background context, which nowadays would rarely be present. Right? Most of the time, if I hauled off and hit one of you upside the head, you would not just naturally assume that that was a teaching. You would have thought I've gone off my rocker and you'd report me to somebody around it, right? The context changes and that whole notion of what counts as immediacy is changed with it. See, the underlying problem with the metaphor of seeing things directly is that it presumes to create a class of enlightened masters who see things directly compared to the rest of us. And it makes it extremely hard to question what they're doing or where to call them out on it. My favorite story in all this was back in the days of the Greyston community with Bernie Glassman, they had borrowed a lot of money and gotten donations to buy this incredible mansion up in Riverdale, but were pretty quickly in over their head, didn't know what to do about the money. They were trying to get more donations. Bernie got the idea of, well, let's see if we can start a bakery, and then that'll make money, and we'll do, you know, all this. So he had all these schemes. He was a real guy who knew how to get things going. And so there was this community debate about, was this a good idea? Should we try to raise money and keep this big, expensive mansion of a building, or was this, you know, a bad idea and we should downsize and not have so much debt? Should we have a business that makes money, or is that go against the principles of what we're practicing? And so the community is trying to argue the back and forth of this, right? And at one point, Helen Twerkov, who's now the editor of Tricycle, stopped everybody and said, there's no point in all of us having this discussion. Whatever Bernie wants to do is what we should do. Bernie is the one person here who really sees things clearly, and we should defer to that. And he said, it's like if my car was broken down on the side of the road and I couldn't get it started, and Bernie pulls up and his pickup truck and offers to fix my car. But what he does is he pulls a chainsaw out of the back of his truck and is ready to go at the engine with the chainsaw. I gotta let him do it because he knows something I don't know. And the whole point of having a teacher is to have absolute faith that he sees things I don't know, right? He sees things clearly. Well, In certain ways, that community allowed Bertie to go at it with the chainsaw, with a lot of different consequences over the years. But I've never heard such a perfect formulation of that notion that the teacher is the one who sees things with a dimension of clarity that's simply unavailable to everybody else. And if that's the case, how can you ever argue with them, right? This is what a metaphor will do to you. Yeah? Bernie, in fact, had all sorts of wonderful insights and visions and ambitions that other people around him couldn't imagine. And he set all sorts of things in motion that the rest of us wouldn't have thought of doing. You know, he really was an imaginative genius in some ways. But he also had all sorts of other mishigas going on, and it's just to, not to get technical, but but he, you know, there was still, in all that he was doing, a great deal of trial and error. In part, his theory was, don't be attached to anything, throw yourself into it, and failure's just as good as success, because it breaks down all your ego-centric expectations. What we have to come to terms with is this idea that it's stories all the way down. And some stories are going to be better than others, and it doesn't mean we have to be resigned to a totally relativistic world. Buddhism basically teaches us that stories that are in denial about impermanence are going to, in the long run, get us in more trouble than stories that include the reality of impermanence, right? But we'll frame that to ourselves in all sorts of different ways. And none of them should ever be confused with seeing reality just as it is.